Are they echoing our thoughts and sentiments? Are they citing our founder and our CTO, Lior, like in the content that they're writing and on podcasts? Buzz for us was like, are people engaging with the content that we put out? And this concept was resonating with people to the point where like our prospects were using our own language to like describe the problem that we were solving.
Ollie Warwick, head of marketing at Monte Carlo, the creator of the data observability category. Prior to joining Monte Carlo over 4 years ago, she led tech brand and engineering in the engineering blog at Uber. And before that, she was a journalist with USA Today, San Jose Mercury News, and even more. She resides in the suburbs of San Francisco with her husband, her son, and cat, Maxie. When she's not slinging software or chasing after her son, she loves to read, catch up on the latest true crime documentaries, and scour the world for good coffee shops. Fun fact, she wrote her college dissertation on Elvis Presley. Molly, excited to have you on today.
Excited to be here. Thanks for having me. I'm Molly. I joined Monte Carlo. And for those who are unfamiliar, Monte Carlo is the creator of the data observability category. And what that means is that we monitor and alert to issues in your data systems. And so obviously, as AI comes to take prominence, that becomes a really big, you know, data quality becomes a really big problem because data is kind of underlying your models and your AI system. So in any case, I joined about 4.5 years ago, leading content and communications. And over the course of the last 4 years, I kind of grew my scope to manage the broader marketing team. So that includes demand generation, events, customer marketing. The company itself is about 200 people. We're Series D, where we keep it pretty lean. We definitely, you know, we have a very much like a sales-led go-to-market motion. But we do a lot of kind of like demand generation and thought leadership and brand awareness and category creation to kind of create you know, excitement and buzz around this category. We've done well for ourselves in that arena.
Thank you for that overview. Excited to dig into some of your category creation experience, your content experience. We'll definitely get there. Before we dive into that, would love to just have you share some advice for those, you know, who maybe look at somebody like yourself, Molly, and think, gosh, like I would love to lead a marketing organization someday. Every path into marketing leadership is kind of like a snowflake. I understand that. But would love any perspectives from you on how to prepare yourself, the experiences that can kind of provide a good groundwork for somebody who's trying or thinking about getting into a marketing role as a leader.
Definitely. I had kind of an unconventional, I guess most people have a unconventional and circuitous route into marketing. So I got my start as a journalist, actually. I was a freelancer for USA Today, and I, you know, worked for the San Jose Mercury News. And then I graduated college, and I realized that I needed to make money. And so I, particularly if I wanted to live in San Francisco, like a lot of my friends were after college. And so I kind of decided that I would go into public relations or at least try my hand at it. At the time, you know, there weren't that many opportunities in tech PR. It was kind of more of like a nascent field. And I found like a video gaming PR agency, actually, that I thought was kind of cool. I wouldn't consider myself a gamer. I did play The Sims a lot growing up, but I'm not particularly a gamer. But a lot of folks that had been to, I went to Stanford, and like a Stanford grad had started the PR agency. And so I was like, oh, this is cool. I'll try this. So I've got my hand, I worked there for a few years, and then I worked at a few other PR agencies doing tech PR for companies like Beyond Gaming. Like I went into and I did PR for VMware and Ford's self-driving car unit and a few other kind of more deep tech companies. And then after that, I actually, oddly enough, my neighbor worked at Uber and he ran their tech brand team at the time. And the tech brand team was responsible for kind of selling Uber as a place that engineers and data scientists and AI researchers would want to work, because they were competing with like Google and Facebook and a bunch of other like big tech companies for talent. And this was in, 2017. So it was kind of right before Uber was going public. It was also right at the kind of the watershed moment when there was a lot going on culturally at the company, and a lot of kind of the brilliant jerks mentality was falling out of vogue and for good reason. And so I joined right around then to manage their engineering blog and their tech brand team. And, you know, it was a really fun and cool experience. And I got to work with some really great leaders like Tuan Pham, who was the CTO at the time, as well as some folks on their like brand and marketing teams. And so I definitely learned a lot there. But my function was not traditionally marketing. It was technical writing and technical brand. And so then, right when the pandemic started, I was kind of at a juncture in my career where I was like, you know, I could stay at Uber and kind of go down this like technical writing or technical program management route, or I could, you know, try my hand at a startup. And so I decided that I would poke around and see what was out there. And I actually saw a job listing for head of content at this company that I, you know, had never heard of. It wasn't even out of stealth, Monte Carlo. This was back in 2020, right at the onset of the pandemic. And I applied, and the rest is history. And so through the course of kind of working at Uber in that kind of unique role where like my job was literally to build a brand around the technology, I kind of found my way to B2B tech, specifically B2B data tech, which again, it's a very like... it takes a very nerdy person to want to do marketing at like a data tech company. And so I joined Monte Carlo, and when I got in, it was really like my goal was to kind of to write and at the time help them create thought leadership around this burgeoning idea of data downtime, which is the idea that like, you know, if your data isn't accurate or unreliable, you can't trust it and it costs companies money and all that stuff. And so our goal was to kind of create a name and like a perspective for the categories of technology that we were building to solve this problem. And so I, you know, did a ton of writing, did a ton of research to really understand the persona. It almost felt like I was a journalist all over again in some ways. And then over the course of the next, almost 5 years, we've like, you know, built out the category to be something that Gartner and Forrester and a lot of other, third party, avenues that we respect, validate. And, you know, we have hundreds of customers and, you know, Fortune 500 and beyond. And, you know, it's been a lot of fun, but to answer your question, my route to marketing has been kind of, it has been untraditional, and whenever I speak to a marketer, like generally, it's a pretty untraditional path. Just because marketing is nowadays it's something you can study in college, but when I was growing up, it wasn't something that I even knew was a career. It was like doctor, lawyer, software engineer, not marketer or B2B SaaS marketer. And so anyway, my advice would be to to really kind of, treat the opportunity like a massive problem to solve, particularly if you're going to do startup marketing, because you don't really know much about your audience at all. You don't know anything about the channels that are going to work. In the early days of Monte Carlo, we were just kind of figuring it out. So a lot of it, it's kind of like you're being a journalist in a way, because you have to figure out like who your audience is, what they care about, what type of, you know, headlines or brand or buzz will get them to actually take your company seriously. It's a lot of investigation, and from there it's really trying to try a lot of app, throwing spaghetti at the wall to really understand what works and what doesn't work, and then leaning in really heavily to what does.
Got it. No, thank you for your background walkthrough there. Really, it, obviously, it goes without saying that your journalist background has, I guess, painted your perspective to an extent on how to, you know, execute against content, right?
Mm-hmm.
You also mentioned, though, that you spent a lot of time with Monte Carlo. You were there as you were creating this data observability category. I would love, actually, today, for the most part, to dig into, you know, given your extensive content background across journalists, your journalistic roles, as well as your time at Uber, and now, you know, even at the beginning with Monte Carlo, I'd love to kind of dig into how content how you can use content to power demand today.
Yeah,
because I think there's a lot of growth and marketing teams, demand gen teams out there who are trying to figure this out, because the way that, you know, buyers make decisions is changing. And insofar as content has been a part of that journey, if that journey changes, then like the role that content plays in that also, you know, to an extent may change. And that's at least my perspective anyway. And I'd love to hear yours. So like from creating a category to, you know, capturing demand, would love to kind of hear your perspective. Mind if we kind of, you know, dive into those topics today?
Yeah, absolutely. So early on with Monte Carlo, the goal was always to kind of like create awareness, create a pain, create an urgency around the problem that we're trying to solve before we do any kind of like actual selling of the product, whether that's, you know, reaching out to prospects and outbounding to them, or just like putting together like gated content or paid campaigns or things where people need to opt in to you know, access these resources. And so you know, we didn't even launch the product or the company before we started writing content and doing a lot of the category creation. We leveraged you know, our CEO is this, you know, really, really intelligent woman, Bar Moses. And so her philosophy was always that, you know, it's all about building a category is all about, you know, creating a movement around whatever value proposition you're trying to sell and the problem that you're trying to solve, as opposed to trying to sell a piece of technology. So at first, it was all about organic content. We didn't even really do SEO until like the first couple years in, although that may have been a mistake. At the time, I didn't know a ton about SEO. Like, I knew what it was, and we did it to a certain extent at Uber, like for the engineering blog. But it wasn't something that I didn't connect B2B SaaS and SEO. But it's a really strong component of that, and increasingly so now that, you know, there's you know, AI is affecting like the Google search algorithms and all that stuff. But in any case, so we started really with just organic content that was posted on Towards Data Science. Which is a Medium blog. We didn't even have a website, so to speak. We would recirculate that content on LinkedIn, which at the time was like, in the height of the pandemic, it was like one of the platforms. I think every social platform was like the platform. Like, I remember Clubhouse. I remember, you know, there was all that stuff going on with Twitter and X.
Totally.
Now,
yeah.
Like, it was, social selling was like a really, really, really strong, avenue during the pandemic. And so we really leaned into that. And it wasn't about like, oh, you need to buy this technology. It was like, you know, are you sick of your data being broken and impacting, you know, your company's revenue? Are you tired of like being woken up at 3 a.m. by your analyst because your dashboards are broken? Like, and definitely related to the pain. And so we started there. And then, you know, after about a year, we hired our first demand gen marketer. This, again, like my awesome counterpart, Angeline. We call her Demangeline just because she like, you know, she basically was able to put together a system so that we could distribute this content and distribute these ideas in a way that was creating brand awareness, but also capitalizing at the right moments and the right parts of our web page. to kind of, you know, capture that intent and drive demand. So then we brought on demand generation, and then like things started to open up. And so we started hosting events again. Events are really right now, during the pandemic, events, they didn't exist. Everything was virtual. Obviously, it took a couple of years for things to warm up. But we're finding, at least in B2B SaaS, is that events are really kind of, they're becoming increasingly important. And, you know, the value of a event lead or an event, kind of a meeting at an event versus something that was booked digitally through a chatbot or another channel, particularly for upmarket, is far and away more kind of valuable and cost effective, which is what we're finding. But that's a bit of an aside. In any case, so, you know, started with content, distributing the content over demand channels, LinkedIn, Google being the primary ones, at least for us at the time, and then kind of like broadening off into events and, ABM and kind of like at home and things like that. We had our first billboard last year around Snowflake Summit, and we had another one at AWS reInvent. And anyway, so that's kind of the journey that we went on.
Hey, yeah, I appreciated your overview of your team's journey there, going from you creating the category. I loved what you said about drawing a strong association between the problems that people were having and your offering and your value proposition, right? When you're creating that category. I kind of want to go back to that because I think category creation is sometimes misunderstood and people underestimate like the challenges that are inherent there. Mm-hmm. There's another alternative path, which is to just find a, latch on to an existing category and try to identify where you can kind of bolt on to that existing momentum. So I guess, do you recall why you chose to go this hard, arduous, like category creation path versus like trying to latch on to maybe something that existed already?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I think it's something that literally every marketer has to grapple with and make the decision to do, because on the one hand, it seems like, oh, new category, bright and shiny, gets, early adopters excited. But on the other hand, it is, to your point, a really arduous journey. It's hard and it doesn't always work. And you can't just decide that you're creating a category. You have to get buy-in from your audience. You have to get buy-in from the broader community. You have to get, validation from third-party sources, whether that's like analysts or G2 or whatever it is. And it was a hard journey. There were moments where I was like, oh my gosh, like, is this going to work? Should we just, become the new Informatica? Like, what are we doing here? But through the content that we put out and kind of the buzz that we were creating about this problem, we identified that like people were really excited about it. It got them really jazzed up, and the way that people were traditionally solving for data quality just was not scaling. It was not working. Like people were moving to the cloud. People were adopting tools like Snowflake and Databricks, and they were not, in these legacy solutions, or, the alternative of just like do nothing or build it yourself was just like not scaling. Yep.
Can I ask you a question there? Like, you mentioned like the buzz, and buzz is another word that it's like, do you have it or do you not have it, right? You want to generate this buzz. What were some of the indicators? What to you is buzz, right? Like, and maybe it looks different across categories, but I mean, I think you were speaking a little bit to it there, but what did that actually look like in practical terms for you at Monte Carlo at that time?
Yeah, so I think buzz for us was like, are people engaging with the content that we put out? Are they echoing our thoughts and sentiments? Are they citing our founder Bar and our CTO Lior, like in the content that they're writing and on podcasts? Like we went through a whole exercise where we were pitching like all the data focused podcasts, all the, deep tech focused podcasts like Software Engineering Daily. There was like a data engineer. There is a data engineering podcast at the time that's really, really popular, Data Engineering Weekly. And this concept was resonating with people to the point where, like, our prospects were using our own language to, like, describe the problem that we were solving. And they were, like, resonating. They were engaging on LinkedIn. They were, like, liking things. They were visiting our website. There was just such, like, a groundswell around it. We were, like, making sure that our CEO was everywhere. She was at I Said Podcast. She was at virtual conferences. You know, she keynoted Web Summit, which is this massive, like, summit summit at Lisbon that, you know, I can't speak to what it's like now, but, like, 3 years ago, it was, like, a very hot place to be, like, just getting the word out there, and it was resonating really well. So oddly enough, before we had HubSpot, before we had Salesforce, we would measure the inbound influence of our marketing by looking at all the likes and engagement and claps on Medium and LinkedIn, which is, like, such a hacky way to do it. And then we would, like, write the names of all the people that were engaging with this content in a massive spreadsheet. And then we would, like, you know, go and outbound to them. And
oh,
often
my goodness,
it would
this
work.
Is hilarious to me. This is great. I love that. Yeah. I mean, I do have to just mention, I mean, I don't, this is not a podcast about Common Room, but yeah, we do the same thing now. It's so funny that we're trying to figure out, like, hey, do people, is this resonating with people? And instead of, you're talking about the literal analog version of, like, what we're doing with tools today, yeah, which is great. I just love when I can see, like, a connection between this is how we all used to do it. Now there's, like, you know, advanced and even better ways and time-saving ways. But I love that you're literally, like, writing down names on a notepad. That's awesome. Anyway.
Yeah, it was very analog. It was very time intensive. I don't know how accurate it was, but it was directionally right. Yeah. It was just kind of crazy. And now looking at HubSpot, like, you know, with the kind of analytics and automations we have with HubSpot, I'm like, how did we do that? I do not understand.
I guess I'm going to pause you there. Like, yeah. So I think there might be, Do you think it's still important for people to pay attention to, like, those upper
social
funnel
signals?
Metrics, those social signals?
Yeah.
Because I think what happens is, my perspective is that you get these tools, right? Out of you get to a point where you've got a HubSpot, you've got a Salesforce, you've got these tools that kind of give you these analytics. I mean, are there things that people are ignoring, do you think, that are actually still valuable because they have so much data availability and be down funnel?
Totally. I mean, I think one thing that I encourage my team to do, and one thing that we did for a very long time, and we still do, and I encourage my team to do, is, like, go on Reddit, go on LinkedIn. Like, what are people engaging with? Like, whenever we have, like, so one thing that my company is known for is we don't take our brand too seriously. Like, a lot of, like, B2B SaaS companies where it almost feels like everything is, like, trying to be open AI. But we, you know, we use memes. Memes are, like, a really one of our kind of core assets that we share on our company social channels. Our CEO shares them too. Our employees share them too. We also write parody songs about the data experience. Like, the one that we just released this week was it was a parody of Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, but it was for, like, you know, data analysts. Anyway, so we always go on LinkedIn and we look at the posts and we see how things are performing and what's working, what's not working, and we apply. We'll reuse that content in paid channels. So we kind of use our organic signals to inform what we do on our paid channels, like everything from, like, content that gets a lot of you know, recirculation in newsletters and reshares on LinkedIn or Twitter is often the basis of our ads or the basis of webinars that we do later or talks that we have, you know, our co-founders present at conferences. Like, it's a really good social signal, informs a lot of our paid marketing strategy.
So, yeah, I think this often a question is, oh, is this message going to land? Right? That's often the question, right? You're redoing, as a marketer, you've redone your, you know, homepage a million times. Maybe not, but, like, that's my experience. It's like,
yeah.
The homepage is this constantly change, ever-evolving thing. And there's always this question of, oh, is our new positioning, our new messaging, is it going to land? Are we striking a chord? So what I hear you saying maybe is that maybe a low, not low fidelity, but a low effort test is just to literally post a meme that ties back to your core value proposition. And maybe it's not a meme for everybody, but for you, you found that memes do a good job at, you know, tying some emotion to your value prop, and then you can kind of identify, hey, does that resonate with people? Does that get people to react? Because that's ultimately what you're looking for, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So an example of this, one of our most successful memes is, I don't know if you remember, this meme that was going around, it was like this little girl, like with a very like a smirk on her face, and there's like a fire, her house is on fire in the background.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Yes. So that would, that one, we applied it to like the idea of like, you know, your data data pipeline breaking and then like causing a, you know, quote unquote fire in your data warehouse. And that resonated so well, like that hit really, really well. To the point where we like redid it, we turned it into stickers that we would hand out at conferences. We, you know, put it on demand generation ads on LinkedIn, and other, like, you know, we use this this third party ad network called Influ2, where you can do like 1-to-1 contacting, and we leverage them there. Anyway, so, you know, we were kind of like, lean into what works, right? Like, why you should not be boiling the ocean to try to find some elusive, incredible brand message. Just lean into what works, even if it's kind of scrappy and it's not perfect. Because if you can harness, if you can understand someone's pain, then that gets you so far as a marketer, because people they respond to pain, fear, kind of like existential dread of like, oh no, like if I don't do this, my data pipeline will be like this. Or like, oh no, my data pipeline is like this. Or, you know, the kind of the art of the possible of like, oh, like if I had this, my data pipelines wouldn't be like this. So yeah, all that is to say, like, we love our memes and we use them at every chance we get.
Got it.
No, I didn't mean to like get you hyper focused on memes, but like, I do think for me, what I'm kind of hearing and learning from you here is that, especially in category creation, it's important to hyper-focus on getting emotional resonance with your problem and identifying what does evoke emotional resonance, right? Like, not just logical resonance, like not the it makes sense, but yes, it needs to make sense, but like it has to really strike a chord. And it seems like you've done a good job there at Monte Carlo from an early stage of simultaneously helping connecting with people's pain and getting them to almost like laugh at their condition or chuckle at their condition, right? Or, you know, possibly sob. I don't know. We don't know what the people are doing on the other side of the screen, but like really like connect with that and then tying it to your value proposition. That represents as like a transition point, right? Like, so in the early days, you said you didn't even have a website, and then you started capturing this demand. Tell me about that. Like, how did your content maybe shift at all, if it did, as you moved from let's just like talk about, you know, let's just be thought leaders, and then shifting to let's capture that demand? Like, how did that, what did that shift look like for you guys?
Sure. So we changed the kind of like strategy a bit, in that we started doing, you know, gated content and things that would help us capture intent. We use this tool called Path Factory. That's like a kind of middle gate content repository. And so what we did is we would continue to write about the topics that our audience cared about, even if it wasn't directly related to data quality or technology. Like, one of our top articles in terms of SEO and page views was this article about what the heck is a data mesh. At the time, a data mesh was like this very technical concept that basically was like, it's like a way of structuring your data architecture and building quote unquote data products. It's like super technical and like, you know, beyond me really, but it was something that resonated really well. And so we wrote about how to build a data mesh, why it's important, blah, 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 going on and on and on about that. Then at the very end of those articles, it would be like, if you want a reliable data mesh, or if you want to build a data mesh, like with data observability in mind, like talk to us. But 90% of the content was just focused on the actual topic of the data mesh. And so we replicated that with a lot of different topics, like building data platforms, building data products, like things that were resonating with our audience and like brought them value and education. And then at the end, it's like, you know, a very specific tie-in, obviously, with your tool, which is, you know, kind of how we were able to be successful. But then we started gating that content and putting together like ebooks and cheat sheets and like land, you know, all sorts of things. We did like surveys with Wakefield Research and other kind of things. We also wrote a book with O'Reilly on data quality, which actually was not intended to be a gated asset initially. It was really just, you know, my CEO was reached out to write this book because she was writing so much about data quality. And so they were like, oh, you know what you're talking about. And so then like we wrote the book together. And so at first it was just a resource we'd hand out at conferences and it like built credibility. And then it was like, oh, you can like source this, and like you can license this. And so it was our top performing piece of content for many years. And so once you kind of understand the audience, you understand the pain, you describe kind of, you portray the art of the possible to them, then you could kind of start capturing that and they're more willing to trust you. And they're like, okay, like I want to learn more. Or like, okay, I want to get more content, or I want to sign up for your newsletter.
Got it. So you kind of, you start with the pain. And then what you described to me was various, use cases or workflows that your audience would naturally see themselves in,
yes.
Right? You're building a data mesh, for example, right? It's like something that's on their mind. They're going to be doing that, right? You want to make sure that you nonchalantly at the end of that suggest that, hey, like, here's how we can maybe plug into your life to make it better, right? Love that transition from, deep pain to let's think through the different use cases and then you introducing yourself from that perspective as opposed to like flipping that on its head where you're kind of jamming yourself into their life, so to speak. So really great insights there. I can nerd out with you on that for a while. However, we do want to move along with our conversation. I would love to hear maybe there's maybe one or two topics that we can go into. And in fact, I'll give you the option. I'd love to maybe two things. One, practical uses of AI in demand gen. I know there's definitely a content play there, but would love to hear just generally how that's going. Or we could chat about another phenomenon that maybe not a phenomenon, but it's something that's certainly a trend that I'm seeing. Is this concept of a founder-led marketing. You spoke to it a little bit with your CEO there at Monte Carlo. Why is that happening? What are some practical experiences you've had with that founder-led growth and content flywheel? Do any of those strike your fancy? Do you want to kind of combine them? Just love to hear maybe your perspective on one or kind of a mesh of the two.
For sure. Yeah, I could speak a bit to, I think the latter, I definitely have a lot of experience in. And the former, like, again, I mentioned Angeline. And so she, I'll say really briefly, one of the most, beneficial uses of AI for our team has been this concept of, a chatbot. It sounds kind of boring, right? Because AI is being, one of the most common use cases of generative AI is a chatbot. But I was a little bit skeptical. I was kind of like, I don't know if this is actually going to bring us value. Like, this just kind of seems like a cool demo. And they were like, it was this company called Qualified. And they were like explaining to me like, how it worked and whatever. And I was like, okay, like, sure. And then Angeline and her team were like convinced that this would be a huge uplift for us, like chatbot conversions, like converted chatbot conversations that started on our chatbot converted really well. But the issue we were seeing is that if people were pinging us at like an off hour, no one was responding to them because the SDRs, weren't available to take their calls and answer their questions. And there's only so much that you can do with these canned responses. So we rolled out this AI chatbot. I think it's called Piper or something like that. And like, this is not like a promotion of the product. I'm not really like, Angeline has been working more with the Qualified team than I have. But since we've implemented Piper, we've seen like a 30% uplift in conversions on the chatbot channel. So that's been huge. So that's an area of AI that I would encourage people to I've always been an AI skeptic. Sometimes I use, OpenAI to generate very, or ChatGPT to generate very basic you know, if I need ideas for like a booth design or if I want to write my kids' preschool applications, like things where I'm like, I just need like a head start here. But this was an area where I think AI was like hugely impactful for us. And then going back to your question about like founder-led marketing or founder-led selling, kind of since starting at Monte Carlo, it's something that I've noticed more and more companies doing. And I think that, you know, I don't want to say that we were some of the, you know, one of the earlier companies to do it, but it's definitely something that we leaned into really heavily, and it tied directly to our category creation efforts. If you don't have a face behind the category or a face behind, you know, whatever problem you're trying to talk about or kind of like a pitch you're trying to give, it's not as successful. Like there are some B2C brands that I think do a pretty good job of building like a brand where it's like, oh, this is funny, or I respect this or whatever. But it takes a lot of time to do, and you have to be really like, you know, you have to spend a lot of money on like brand and like awareness campaigns and Super Bowl commercials. And, you know, if you think about like Jack in the Box is one of our customers. I'm a huge fan of them. I grew up in Southern California. They're based there, they're in San Diego, I think. But in any case, they have a very distinct brand identity. It's like the Jack in the Box. Mm-hmm. And again, not that Jack in the Box is a founder, but it's like a person and it's a thing, like very, very closely associated with the brand. Or when you think about Burger King, it's the King, or McDonald's, it's Ronald McDonald's. Like they all have like a mascot or like a, not the founder, but like someone who's like very, very much part of their marketing persona, and it builds credibility, it builds like a friendly face. And I would say a lot of the startups that I've seen be more successful have like a very public CEO or CTO who kind of is a valuable resource for their customers and their prospects, versus just kind of being like a, you know, a figurehead. Like they're actually like, you know, meeting with the customers, they're writing content with the customers, they're like doing all these things. And Bar did that a lot very early at Monte Carlo, and it was massively successful. And now whenever we talk to like prospects, we're always like, hey, how'd you hear from us? What are, you know, we want to understand what channels are working. And anecdotally, like always it's like, oh, well, I really like Bar's content. I really trust Bar because of like her thought leadership. I saw her speak at Snowflake Summit. Like, and that's kind of the entry point to some of these customers.
Got it. Yeah. So I think that it's no secret that some leaders and founders are predisposed to be a face, right? Mm-hmm. To be out there, to want to engage. And there are others, in some cases, who you don't feel as comfortable posting or as comfortable being on perpetually like online or those types of things. In the former case, it feels like a relatively natural thing to do. It just organically happens, where it's founder-led content, right? Founder-driven, founder-led content. And then maybe there's this other side, which is like, who does the driving? If does it work? Is it possible? What would you suggest to companies, to marketing leaders who are saying, gosh, dang, like I would really want to make this happen, but, you know, they get pushback from, you know, whether it's the founder or the CEO. Like, I think that's a thing that happens sometimes.
I would say, you know, for a B2B SaaS, hire a field CTO. I know hiring, like I'm not really an advocate for hiring for hiring's sake or throwing bodies at a problem. But I strongly believe that, like, you will expedite your sales cycle. You will, like, open new doors if you have someone versus, like, you know. It's a little bit different when you have an open source tool where it's like, hey, like, you build trust, you build credibility because you have this tool that's free and anyone can use it. And, you know, you build credibility that way. But if it's a sales-led motion, it's a little bit harder to do that. I would say, like, you can also outsource this to other people on the team. Gong is a really strong example of this. They had, I'm sure you're familiar with Devin Reeder and like his whole, you know, he's kind of like the king of like social selling. He's not the CEO or co-founder, but he kind of assumed the mantle of being like the public face of Gong. And I think that like when you're doing B2B SaaS, particularly sales-led motion, you really need to have someone who drives that forward, even if it's not your founders.
It seems like a minor point, but I think it's an important one in the distinction you're making between, in your case, you said open source, and in the non-open source world, where it might be your product-led companies, end users can adopt and just develop a love for your offering.
Yes, like a Datadog or something.
Yeah, Datadog, a Monday.com, wherever it is, like getting started on your own, right? Money.com might not be a great example. It's multiplayer, but I understand your point. On the other side, though, if you don't have that, I think it's a good point that you need to build trust, right? One way to build trust is to prove it, right? Prove it. Like we'll prove to you that we can make your life better. And but sans being able to just prove it, well, how else do you do that? Well, you do that with a figurehead, somebody who can just be that person having a casual fireside chat, so to speak, with thousands or millions of people, depending on your audience size, and becoming that trusted advisor, that trusted voice, that person that they turn to for advice, right?
Exactly.
That is really like what they need to become. So I really love that point, and I think that's probably a good one to maybe end on. I would say one last question on like any last. I guess content has changed a whole bunch. I guess the role that content is playing, the types of pieces of content that work, the jobs that content needs to do, maybe they've changed. I guess over the past 5 years or so, what has maybe changed the most with respect to content's role and the job that it needs to do within like the whole demand creation and capture cycle? And maybe what are the underlying principles that you just think are evergreen and haven't changed? Because I think we can all get caught up in these hype cycles, and would love to hear your perspective on that, and then we can finish off.
Yeah, I mean, I think like you mentioned AI earlier, and I think one of the biggest areas that marketers have thought or have not even thought, but have been using AI is to generate content. Right? Like, you know, you can use AI, use ChatGPT, you can use like, I think Otter AI is another, like there's a bunch of different tools that you can use to generate content with AI. Like you put some inputs in of like what you want it to write about, and it pops up whatever. But, and that can get you so far, but there will always need to be a human in the loop to make sure to bring it up a couple levels. Like I would say quality trumps quantity always. Like you could generate like 10 ebooks with ChatGPT. You'll get some results. People will download it. People will click on it if you have like a buzzy title. But the people that actually stop to read it, like, is it going to get them value? Like, probably not as much as someone who is like a subject matter expert, like actually either writing the content or taking the content that the GPT writes and making it better. I would say quality always trumps quantity. That's the same with like SEO or anything. Like we find that like the five articles are the pieces that generate the most traffic to our blog, and we have hundreds of blog articles. As an example, like the topics that resonate the most with our webinars, like they will always be the topics that that get the most people to RSVP, and we host like dozens of webinars every year. Or so I would focus on like really trying to do something, really try to do one or two things really, really well, really focus on quality over quantity, and that will get you like 90% of your results.
Really appreciate that. I think that's sage, really good advice. I will definitely be even thinking about that myself as I think most teams out there, whether you're even in marketing, sales, wherever you are, you're thinking about how do we use AI to improve my workflow, to improve our content. and understanding. And then there's the relationship between AI and humans, and it's a touchy subject, and it's something that, we are all concerned about in one way or another, in the broadest sense of the term concerned. I think that's really, really great advice. Before we wrap up, I have two questions for you, Molly. First question, what's maybe a secret, a marketing secret that you've learned and incorporated that you've seen has led to outsized results?
Memes. No. That's a good question. I would say, besides memes, I would probably say like simplicity. Simplicity of message is key. I think when you're building a category, like I think that there's a tendency for more technical marketers and when you're marketing a more technical product to try to touch on every little thing that your product does to differentiate it from the competition. But by doing that, you lose sight of what makes it, of what makes it special and unique when you're trying to like one up all of your, competitors. So I would say like simplicity is key when it comes to messaging what I would say.
Got it. And then what's a strongly held belief or like a hill you're willing to die on with respect to marketing strategy, go-to-market execution?
Hire a brand designer earlier than you think you need one.
Ooh, that's interesting. That's a hot take. I think people would... That's what I wanted.
Yes.
One follow-up to that. The simple like TLDR? Why? Like, what's the implication if you don't potentially?
Well, at Monte Carlo, for a very, it's not the case anymore, but for a very long time, everyone on the marketing team was living in Canva, and there was just a lot like. I'm a proponent of like not I think being scrappy and being fast is super important when you're a startup, but you reach a certain point and you can only use that image of a computer screen so many times before you're like, okay, I need some support here. So yeah, I would say hire a brand designer just before you think you need one, because when you really need one, you're gonna be in like, significant design debt. And not to say that Monte Carlo was in that place. I think every company deals with it to a certain extent, and in some ways, like we're proud of this. Everyone now is like very fluent in Canva, but I think particularly as you mature, there's so much can be said with a good, simple slogan and a really good design.
Love it. Well, on your last two questions, what's clear is you want to keep it simple. So it's been a lot of fun just having this conversation. Would love to have another hour on this conversation. So much that I could even learn from you. So thank you for sharing your time, your perspectives with us. How can people find you? And how can they best reach you if they have questions or follow-ups?
Definitely. I'm on LinkedIn, Molly Forwork. There's not many of us, so you'll find me pretty quickly. I also am at mvorwork at montecarlodata.com if anyone has questions or wants to reach out. And fun fact, we are actually hiring a brand designer. So if anyone knows one, please, that you respect and love, please feel free to reach out.
There you go. Molly, thank you so much for your time today, and I hope to catch up sometime soon in another strain. So thank you.
Likewise, thank you so much.